during the book of Shmuel, Jonathan, King Saul's son, had led an attack single-handedly against the Philistines, and he was successful. And then war erupted, and Saul began attacking the Philistines very successfully. And he took a vow. He said, no one's allowed to eat so that we focus on our war, our battle against the Philistines. They enter the forest, and they see dvash. What's dvash? Dvash, we would think, is honey. But our sages say that dvash, Rashi says, is any sweet liquid. And our sages say here there was sugar cane. That's why it speaks about the stalk with honey. What stalk has honey? It's talking about sugar cane. And there was sugar dripping out there. So you see, they had sugar growing in Israel at that time. Sugar cane. Yeah, that's what Rashi in Tractate Erevin writes. That this verse is talking about sugar cane. In Song of Songs, it says, I ate the stalk with the honey. What stalk and honey? It's talking about sugar cane. Achalti ya'ari im divshi. It says that's talking about sugar. So no one's touching the sugar. Everyone's hungry. And Jonathan wasn't there. Remember, Jonathan went and led the attack before everyone else. So he wasn't around when his father made the vow that no one may taste from the food till they finish the attack. And he takes to eat from the honey. And people see him. He's the only one who's eating from it. And one of the people tell him, you know, your father said, cursed person who eats before nightfall should die. Okay, Jonathan says, you know, my father did something very bad. He's destroying the troops. Everyone's tired. Look at me. I have much more strength to continue fighting because I'm eating. Why'd my father do such a thing? But no one ate. So they continue their attack, and they're going eastward. They're going from Michmas. Remember, the battle began at Maale Michmas. That's right near where I live, in Kochav Yaakov. That's right in the Binyamin region, just east of Jerusalem. And they continue, and the nation's tired. And that night, they start slaughtering cattle to eat. And when they slaughter the cattle, they're so hungry that they don't cover the blood, or they don't properly check the knives, or they don't sprinkle the blood. Different opinions as to what they did wrong. And Saul hears that the people are eating improperly. And Saul gets very upset at them. He says, we had such a great salvation today. We were outnumbered over 100-1. How could you do such a thing? So he says, quickly, we'll erect an altar. They erect an altar, a single stone altar. And Saul himself checks their knives. The halacha says that the chief rabbi of the town is supposed to check the shochet's knife. He's not supposed to shech without having approval from the chief rabbi. And then everyone eats. Saul says, let's continue attacking the Philistines tonight, now that we've all eaten, and we'll loot them till the morning, and we'll finish them off. And the Kohen says, let's ask Hashem. So he asks Hashem, should I go down after the Philistines? And Hashem doesn't answer him. So Saul says, let's understand, we did something wrong if Hashem's not answering us now. So Saul says, I promise by Hashem, he gave us such a salvation today, that even if it's my son Jonathan who did something wrong, he's going to die. And no one says a word. Everyone's quiet because they all know that it is Jonathan. So he understands from the silence that there's something going on here. So he says, okay, it could be either me and my son or you, because the leadership sometimes held accountable. We'll start with a lot between you and us. And the nation says, whatever you say. So the lot falls there, and it falls on Jonathan. And Shaul says, it falls first on Shaul and Jonathan, and then they draw a lot between Shaul and Jonathan, and it comes out to Jonathan. And Shaul asks him, what'd you do? So Jonathan says, I ate some of the sugar that was floating. And Shaul says, okay, you're going to die today. And Jonathan doesn't say a word. And the nation steps up to the plate, and the nation says, Jonathan is the one who began this whole salvation today. How could he die? We insist he shouldn't even lose a hair. Obviously, Hashem was with him. Look at what a miracle Hashem did on his behalf. And so the nation, being that Saul made a vow which obligated everyone as a whole, that the people who were there could annul that vow. And so they annulled the vow, and Yonatan walked away unscathed.
Can I go ahead with
him? Yes.
Yeah.
Well, they did it in accordance with Halacha, but we're starting to see how Shaul is making mistakes. He's not the one who led the victory to the war. At the end of the victory, he's prepared to kill the great victor of the war. As great as Shaul is, because to stand up when he's outnumbered 100-1, that's very scary. And he did it. But at the end of the day, we're seeing weaknesses in Shaul's leadership. You see, the nation was able to redeem Yonatan. Shaul was ready to kill Yonatan.
But what was he supposed to do?
Well, that's a good question, but the Navi is showing us something here. And he does not finish off the Philistines. He was victorious in the battle, but he didn't follow through. So he steps back, and the Philistines can reconvene their army. The Navi gives us a pasuk, two psukim, which are very important, and most people don't even know they're written. The pasuk says that he was successful in his military campaigns against Ammon, Moab, Edom, the kingdoms of the north, Amalek, and he saved Israel from all their enemies. In 2 years. Remember, Shaul's reign lasted 2 years. So when we read about Shaul, we always walk away with Shaul's failures. And we fail to see what a tremendous king he was, where he starts off his reign, there's no weapons. The people have not a single sword. And he leads them to these great victories. So we have to see it in the proper light. The rest of what we're going to learn about Shaul is really going to be Shaul's downfall. But let's remember these two psukim, because Shaul was a giant. So we now move forward to the story where Shmuel sends Shaul to fight Amalek. Shaul has amassed an army. He's gained certain peace with the Philistines. And one of our mitzvot when we enter the land of Israel is establish a king. And once you have a king, go out and fight Amalek. So Shmuel tells Shaul, go and fight Amalek and don't leave anyone behind. So Shaul gathers everyone. He has 200,000 soldiers, 10,000 from Judea. And he starts attacking. And as he's preparing for the attack, he starts thinking. And he says to himself, there's that heifer that if a person's found killed and you don't know who murdered him, so you bring a special calf by a stream, and you see how much God values life, so maybe over here, what did the women do? And if the men were sinful, what did the children do? So Shaul is starting to think, how can I be more humanistic in this attack? And Shaul begins by telling the descendants of Jethro, Yisro's children, why don't you guys leave, because we're about to attack Amalek, and why should you get hurt? And then he starts his attack. We see that the first step of humanistic behavior was proper. His first call to the family of Yisrael to leave and not get hurt, that was correct. The next step, Shaul starts thinking, let's not kill Agag. Agag was the king who was captured, and they left him alive. And that night he slept with the maid in his cell. And from that, the maid became pregnant, which ultimately leads to the man, Haman Ha'agagi, the descendant of Agag. The soldiers that he had were able to get dressed up. The Medrash says they were able to say different types of sorcery so they would turn into sheep. Or else it means they got dressed up among the cattle. And the nation said, we'll leave behind some cattle. We'll offer it as a sacrifice to Hashem. So Shaul and the people have mercy over Agag. They have mercy over the cattle. And they didn't want to destroy everything. They didn't want to be destructive. We can understand that. But Hashem had told them not to do that. And this is strike two. Remember, strike one was that he delayed and that he brought the sacrifice too early. Hashem had told him to wait till Shmuel came, and he did not. We understood he was under tremendous pressure. He was being attacked. We can't fault him. The Torah faults him. And strike two is that he does not finish the job against Amalek, which again, it's easier said than done. I remember in those days, every time you killed someone, it was with a sword. It wasn't that you pushed a button and a missile landed and you never saw their faces in the mind. It was with a sword. You saw the person. You felt them die. I mean, it was a more gruesome thing, the battlefield back then.
That was part of the purification process, how people come to terms with what they did. Like after the battles that they were supposed to be separated, I think. Isn't that right?
Maybe. I don't know.
Or was that, am I thinking the right way?
Yeah, you're right that people had to purify themselves. I don't know that that was a part. We have a promise in the Torah. The Torah promises that even though we will go to war, we will not become cruel people.
Yeah.
There's a promise in the Torah that we will retain our human care, even though we will fight battles. And we happen to see that promise come true with the IDF. You see, the most hardened soldiers who do all kinds of things, they come home and they're very fine people. When people have Torah, so then they can do that. That's what David the Melech has described as Adino Ha'etzni, the soft stick. So our sages say, David, when he would be in the Beis Medrash, he'd be soft like a worm. You push a worm this way, it folds that way. That was David. You would try to talk to him in the Beis Medrash, you'd meet the softest, gentlest, warmest, kindest person in the world. And then when he'd go out to the battlefield, he'd take his sword and he'd kill 800 people before he'd stop to rest. He was the toughest warrior. And it wasn't a contradiction, because when you learn Torah, you're supposed to develop within yourself the bravery and the ability to apply your strength to protect people, even if it means killing the enemy, and yet retain the dignity and the humanistic compassion to the point where we find David, he has compassion even over a servant that he finds. A slave, a Mitzri, an Egyptian slave, he finds him along the way, sick and dying, and David takes the time and he takes care of him, and it's not a contradiction. You fight with all the vigor that you need to, and you maintain the mercy and compassion. That's a balance, which is very hard to fathom, but the Torah promises us we'll be able to do it with the Torah. Yeah.
Mercy and whatever with his son, and slaughtering his son. So too, should you be merciful to us? So that's like it's the same interesting concept. Like, there's time to be merciful and time not to be merciful.
Right, and our sages warn us that if a person is merciful to those that he should fight, when he applies mercy in the wrong place, to those that are cruel, so then he will ultimately be cruel to those that are merciful. Our sages say you will not be able to do both. If you go too far and you try to be merciful to those who are cruel, so then ultimately you will find yourself being cruel to those that are merciful. There's a time to you have to fight evil. And when a person says, let me be kind to the evil, so then he will find himself being cruel to those that are really kind.
You see, I
don't want to say it. Yeah.
I think you can be compassionate to those on the other side, but when it comes, you have to have a line that you're not going to put your own at risk in order to be kind to the other side.
That's for sure.
In taking too far.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we put our own soldiers in danger and we harm our own people because we want to be more compassionate than anyone else in the world. So I think we end up being merciful to those who deserve the opposite, and we end up being cruel to those who deserve mercy.
I think that's one way of looking at it, but I would look at it differently.
It's very easy to say. Hashem doesn't ask something simple. He asks to slaughter everything alive. I mean, little children. He asks them to kill little children.
I definitely agree with Daniel, and that's why I would word it a little differently.
Like this, you know, you see a little junkie, you know, why are you supposed to, you know...
Soldiers told me what you just said. Mm-hmm. Soldiers told me that when they were learning about it before they went to battle, so they went to Hezder Yeshiva, and they said, everyone's the enemy, and you have to fight him. They said, you're standing in Gaza, and a five-year-old boy comes over to you, and you know he might be carrying a suicide belt, but you can't shoot him. You look at a sweet kid, and you can't shoot him, and you know you're risking your own life. They said to me, theoretically, in theory, when you first come out to the battlefield, you tell yourself, I'm not going to let them kill me. And then after a year or two or three, you start looking at yourself in the mirror and you say, can I shoot a five-year-old kid? He might be wearing a suicide belt, and I don't know. But can I shoot him? And can I live with myself if I didn't? They said, in theory, we knew it before we went in. But day after day, year after year. And that's why I view it a little differently. I think that... I think that if a person takes his strength from Torah, if a person can say, I am working with the most ethical system in the world because Hashem gave it and he knows what's right and wrong, and therefore I'm right in what I'm doing, so then a person can take all the necessary steps. If a person is going to say the logic the other way, so then a person can, if a person is just going to say, I have to view them as an enemy, so then he's going to say, but maybe not. Maybe that five-year-old kid is not my enemy. And can I live with myself if I killed him? So if I say I'm working with the system and I know what I'm doing is right, this is what the system wants of me, and I believe in that system, so then I can live with myself. But I have to be there. And if I'm not there, so then I think it becomes very hard. Again, that might be easy to say from the comfort of this room, but when you see the child, I'm not sure that's so easy to say, and I'm not sure you can say that 10 times. Maybe the first time he shot at the kid, he could say that. But what happens day after day? They're trying to wear them down. They do this all the time. That's when it becomes very difficult, and I understand that it's difficult, and I'm not sure. If a person doesn't strengthen his connection to Torah, I'm not sure that they can stand up to that challenge. It's very, very hard. You know, they purposely send women and young children. It's hard. It's hard. We're human beings at the end of the day.